Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to another episode of America Trends. John Kropczyk and Larry Rifkin. And John, this is a really important one. And oftentimes our podcasts originate with us seeing a headline or two somewhere. And if we see it more than once, we say, there's something going on here that enough people are reporting on that we have to follow because it is looking more and more like a trend. And this trend that I'm talking about is the birth rate declining in the U.S., at the fastest pace, the decline, since 1918.
Wow.
Now, when was the Spanish flu, John? Was that 1919?
That might have been the same time.
Yeah. Interesting, as we look at it 100 years later.
I was just thinking, you know, maybe we're going to have corona, maybe, but maybe not.
I don't know. That's an interesting thing. I know that there have been many hurricane babies and many other babies.
Right, blackout babies.
Blackout babies, yeah. Hey, I didn't know that was going on. I couldn't see. Well, the past year's population growth rate in the U.S. was the slowest in a century due to declining births. Now, that got our attention, but this gets it even more as we get older, increasing deaths and the slowdown of international migration. And you can fix a few of those things. You can allow more immigrants in. You can encourage more babies. But to do that, you have to have some public policies that encourage young women in particular, who are now the growing part of this knowledge-based economy. I mean, think about it. And Dowell Myers, who joins us, he's a professor of urban planning and demography at the University of Southern California. And he said some things that really blew my mind. And Dowell Myers joining us today has something really interesting to say. And think about this, John, because you have a daughter of that age, and she has had a child. But for young women who want to have professions, who ultimately get married and then want to buy a house and perhaps in the course of all of this have a child, probably the thing that they delay the longest often
is having a child.
Exactly. So, well, they realize, gee, we just took on this mortgage. Maybe we better wait another couple of years to replenish because the down payment took a lot of our savings
away. As you get older, it's also harder to have kids.
Exactly, John. Thus, the dilemma that we're talking about in this podcast today. And one of the other things that he says in the course of this podcast that I'll just lead you to and hope that you will really think about this, roll this concept around in your mind. He says that anyone born from 1985 on, because they do put a number on our value, John, depending upon if we're part of the baby boom generation. There were lots of us. So in many ways, we were somewhat more expendable because we had so many kids being born. But then you had different generations, which were slighter than ours, or those like millennials, where many were born. But Generation Z and X and this and that didn't have as many. So the point that I'm bringing out is he said that anyone born from 1985 on in America has more value to our society than someone born before it.
Wow.
Now, that's a pretty remarkable thought.
That is remarkable.
But roll it around, John, meaning that we better educate these kids. They are going to be the future of our society, and we need to value and cherish them and support them in ways that we might not have considered in the past because we have fewer of them. It's a thought to really you know, conjure up in your mind a lot of ideas about what we need to do from a public policy standpoint. And, you know, this was one of the first times in a presidential campaign. It was Elizabeth Warren talking about a child policy, about daycare and the like, because I was thinking about this. I mean, just factor this in. A lot of people talking about a free college education. And by the time somebody's gotten to that point with their family, in many cases, they've built up some reserve. They've been in the workforce for many years. What about a child care policy where we know it's gotten so darn expensive, child care? And we will deal with this in an upcoming podcast in a larger sense about daycare. But think about that, John. Would it be better to invest in the early stages of the development of that child so that the mother and father can both be in the workplace, because we need them to be in this workplace? And maybe it's not as important, the college piece to this.
Boy, now that you think about it, it does make a lot more sense, because that's when the crunch is, right? They got to go to work. The kid's small. Yeah.
And we're seeing that with coronavirus. I mean, how many young families, and if you're one of our younger listeners, I mean, how strapped you are and how difficult this time is for you to do all the things that are important as your children are there, your job is still making demands on you. It's a really difficult time. And so I think we really have played this out in a way that we never thought. And I think we as a society are going to be giving thought to that. But anyway, we talk about this declining birth rate and its many impacts on our society with a great demographer today on America Trends. I think this is a really important topic to delve into, don't you, John?
I do. It's very important.
All right. We're doing it today for you. So stay with us.
With me on the line is Gowell Myers, who's a professor of urban planning and demography at the University of Southern California. And I wanted to chat with him because there are some important demographic shifts in America. And Professor Myers, last year's population growth in the U.S. was the slowest in a century, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Only 3.8 million babies were born in the U.S., and that number seemingly was offset by the fast aging baby boom population, and of course, many of whom are beginning to fall away at this stage. Is this a cause for alarm in your view?
Slower growth by itself is not cause for alarm, but growing such a top-heavy population and has so many seniors, so many elderly, is definitely, it's unprecedented. It's never happened in our society. It hasn't happened prior to this century. It never happened on the planet. So we're really, it's a very heavy burden to carry, because all our seniors have lots of entitlements that they have earned. And to make good on that, we have to have enough working age people underneath them. And it's shrinking at the bottom. So that's it's an inverted pyramid now. It used to be a broad base at the bottom and a few seniors on top. Now it's a lot on top and kind of shrinking at the bottom.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And also, in a way, and the fact that you're in Southern California probably makes this even more relevant, when you think about the American culture over the years, it's been a youth induced culture, drenched with sun, hope, possibility, fast cars. And so obviously even the tenor of our society changes when in fact this top heavy inversion takes place.
That's right. We're getting a temporary burst right now because we have a large millennial generation. And so they're kind of invigorating the 20s, but then it falls off again after that. And before the millennials was Gen X, we call it. It's between the baby boomers and the millennials. There was a series of very low birth years in the 1970s, and it created this very small generation that has disappeared from the political landscape. There's no Gen X political leaders. I think Pete Buttigieg is like the, he's like, you know, I guess he's right on the edge between millennial and Gen X.
Because my son is 37. So I think he is a millennial by definition, 1982, I think it was,
Yes, that's right, the dividing line, But we have all these, you know, octogenarian politicians. It's like, it's very strange. But it signifies our population. We have just a top-heavy age structure.
I did a podcast with a gentleman from Politico, and he called it America, the Gerontocracy. When we look at our leadership in Congress, and we look at our president and many of the candidates running. So it is a really interesting phenomenon. When I look at the factors involved in what's going on, you've got the declining births, you've got increasing deaths, and you've got a slowdown in international immigration or migration. At least 2 out of 3 of those are reversible, but even life expectancy in America is going down just a little bit, and that should be reversible, I mean, given all the medical advances, I would think.
Depends on when you measure expectancy. If you measure it at birth, people have to go through the hazardous 20s. Mm-hmm. But if you measure people after they get to age 65, they still have a long, growing expectation of length of life after 65. I hope that's clear how I said that. It's just the total, you know, total risk of death is greater for people who are younger. Crashes or drug overdoses and things happen, but people in their 50s and older live safer lives. And for them, the health improvements are so great that anybody who gets past age 50 is looking at longer and longer life expectancy.
Let's talk about the women of childbearing age in America. They seem to be single longer, active in the workforce, often delaying, if not foregoing, childbirth. What are the implications of this trend?
Children are the, that's the future. Literally, it is the future. Demographers say the future comes in on tiny feet. and it's produced through volunteer activities of individual citizens, oftentimes working in pairs. It takes a couple to really raise a child. But we don't really know what to do about it. We don't invest much in it. It's a very low priority of the public, and yet the public is totally dependent on these children. My thesis is that we took children for granted. And our political culture is basically something that's been formed over the last couple of decades or last 4 decades. So it's always lagged from the past. And the era of the 1950s and 60s, we were just swimming in kids. The baby boom was on, and it was it followed after the Great Depression years and the war years when birth rates were low, and so we had this surge of kids, and I was part of that. I mean, my first school, it was in double sessions, and we had portable units, and it was still in double sessions.
Yeah, I had that.
Incredible.
Yeah.
We just overwhelmed the system, and so we didn't need any more stinking kids. I mean, basically, and we couldn't afford them. And basically, that's the attitude that's still built into public policy, even though everything is reversed now. Now we have shrinking numbers of kids, and we're top heavy. We weigh more older people than young people, and it used to be the other way around. And I've calculated that every child is twice as valuable now to society as like a kid born before 1985. It's enormously different. Part of the problem is the way we divide up responsibilities between the federal government and the state government or state and local government. The feds are in charge of old people, or as Paul Krugman puts it, think of the federal budget as being an old age home that also has a military, and that's where the bulk of the money goes. And so Social Security, Medicare, all that goes through the federal government. Well, children are funded by the state and locals. 90% of all the costs of education are by state and local government. And so the children are the investment in the future. That's being done locally. Mm. And the old people are being rewarded for past service by the federal government. They don't make investments. They just run deficits. The state governments can't run deficits. They're not allowed
right.
to.
And so that's a really interesting point that I never really thought about. What about, you alluded to it earlier, we would seem to need more caregivers for the aging population, but if the number of immigrants is declining and more women are in many other careers than caregiving, which was one of the career paths of the past, who's going to take care of all the older Americans?
Well, again, that's an echo of the past where, like, my mother had 3 kids, and so she had potential 3 kids to help her. But the 3 kids themselves are only, so far among them, have only produced 2 kids. So three kids have got 2 grandkids. And so now we have a generation that's getting older with the ratio of potential family support is way lower. It's the opposite of what it was. And so it's going to push more, put more requirements on hiring private help from somewhere where there's a shortage of workers, or we don't know how it's going to work. Maybe a robot will take care of mom in the future. Mm. I don't think mom might get. My mom was taken care of by an immigrant woman who she loved dearly, and it was a very warm relationship. And we don't want a robot taking care of mom.
Well, let's talk about migration. I mean, there are many countries historically that have taken in immigrants, America being one of them. But now we're not so welcoming. I was reading where the numbers have dropped to over 500,000, I believe, last year, about 1 million in 2016. And even those numbers seem quite slight to me when you look at America and the expanse of America. But are we really on the international scene getting a bad reputation for our hospitality and how welcoming we are? And how quickly do we need to turn that around? Because it doesn't look as if some of these other trends are going to change anytime soon.
Well, the U.S. takes in a larger share of the world's immigrants than any other country by far. So we have been very hospitable and welcoming in the past. I mean, we're a nation of immigrants. We have a long tradition of assimilating immigrants. We're very successful. The European countries don't have that tradition. They've been more exporters. They just don't have they don't know how to bring in people of different cultures. Japan is a total failure at it as well. And their population is declining in total now. And they're in a death spiral because as your population goes down, you have fewer potential mothers each generation and fewer potential babies, and they're shrinking away. And they can't get an infusion of foreign-born to come in because their culture does not allow it. It's just not designed for it. So it's really a major strength of the U.S. economy in the 21st century that we have this ability. And we haven't lost. It's just a temporary pause right now because it'll be blindingly obvious within 5 years that as the baby boomers continue to retire, that this low unemployment we have right now, it's not going away. If we have a major recession, the unemployment rate is going to blip up only a little bit, and then it's going to dive downward again. We don't have enough workers right now. And if you cut off the inflow of the new workers, businesses can't operate, and the business community will make sure that immigration is restored.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Dowell Myers is with us on America Trends. We're talking about the demographics of America that have been changing. Let me ask you, this will be a five-part question. No. When I look at young women today, many of whom are well-educated, they're going into the workforce. They have many different options. And it's probably hard to get off that career track, particularly since many are in very expensive areas, urban areas throughout the country. And so they're having to make some really difficult choices. As you say, the states are more responsible for child care and daycare and these kinds of things, and they're not terribly well-funded. So, we're looking at later family formation as a result, which changes the economy. And when they're living in these urban areas, they're not buying some of the hard goods, not buying automobiles in many cases. So if you put this picture in some focus for us.
It's a neglected area. I'll tell you that the millennials don't get no respect. I'm a boomer myself, and I have two millennial children, and I have a bunch of millennial students, and I study these things, and I'm amazed at what's happening. They had the misfortune to come of age right in the teeth of the Great Recession. that really set them back. But for the women in particular, they've altered their lifestyle so dramatically. It used to be that men had a higher rate of going to college than women did. But sometime in early 2000s, women caught up. And since then, they've gone well ahead of men. The men have stagnated with their college-going rate, and the women keep rising and rising and rising. The knowledge-based economy is well-suited to the talents of women. They're our smartest students, and they are in great demand in the labor market, more than the men are. The problem is that young women have this clash of competing priorities that have to be resolved in the same 15 years of their life. They need to complete their education. They need to get their career started. They need to start their families. And they might also want to buy a house. Of those four competing things, the family one, if it involves kids, is just not compatible. You can do the career, you can do the education, those go together. If you get the money from that, you can buy the house. But the kid it sets them back. We need to do much more with providing parental leave and supporting daycare to make it easier for young women to combine these duties. And they have to happen in the same 15 years. You can't say, well, okay, we'll have the kid when I'm settled later after 40. You know, it doesn't work that way. You could say I could buy a house later, and they are delaying buying houses, definitely. But all this is a crunch that comes on young people, and I think it's not fair that they should be the ones who have to solve the problem, because the solution actually is a solution for the rest of us. It's the older people who need their kids being born, because the older people need to have these kids grow up to be good taxpayers who support all the old people.
It's
the employers who need to have these kids born. It's all the rest of us.
I guess that's assumed. That assumes we care about deficits and debt, which we don't seem to be too worried about, which is startling. Let me ask you this. It's been reported that the rate of American women of childbearing age, when they are asked to express an interest in starting a family, it hasn't changed really that much in the past decade, nor has the notion of the ideal number of children in a family probably too. And yet there is also a growing body of research, and maybe you have other information, that questions the notion that later in life pregnancies are much riskier. So are we seeing just a delay in childbearing, or are we seeing just a decline?
It's good news and bad news. The good news is that we're not seeing teenage mothers like we used to. That's really been curbed, and I think it's much healthier for all young women to, you know, get their life started before they all of a sudden saddle with motherhood. And everybody agrees on that policy, and that's been a big success. On the other hand, on the bad news side is you can't delay too long, because the uptick in fertility after age 35 is small compared to the drop in fertility under age 25. The two aren't matching each other. And so you just can't make up for what you put off earlier. I was looking at the numbers. It's interesting that, you know, back in 1990, the age 2024 was just about the highest rate of childbearing. It was tied with 25-29. And now 2024 has really declined. And 25-29-year-old mothers are also declining. So the 30-34-year-old mothers, used to be way behind, are now creeping above and maybe the most likely age to have a baby, early 30s. So it's a major transformation. It's good, and it allows young women to develop their lives independently of their obligations to children. And then they can make decisions how they want to do that. But they only have a short little window then. If they're aiming at in the early 30s, they have to tighten the window more narrowly. And as I hear them say oftentimes, it's like they didn't find a man to be a partner at the right time. And they may have found him when they were 25, but they didn't find him when they were 35. Or they found him later when they were 45, but it was too late. So that's an awful burden to have to try to thread the needle like that.
Absolutely. You alluded to it. I mean, we have seemingly, and I'd love to get your comments on this, a boy crisis in America. As you say, they are not attaining at the levels that girls are in school. And for many girls, they may not be desirable partners with whom to have a child at a young age. And when we've got this marketplace that needs these educated young women in many different facets that were closed off to them before, I would imagine that even employers are putting a lot of pressure on young women to stay in the workforce, giving them incentives not to look to either have a child alone or to, you know, find that mate and get busy making a family.
I mean, employers, the good employers are offering more family incentives now because they know that young women are concerned about that. So it's a, it's a perk they offer that will get them to recruit, and then hopefully they can use the use these workers for a few years before they cash in their family benefits. But it's definitely the more upscale employers are all trying to compete because there is a shortage of workers, and they're competing for the best talent by offering more and more parental leave. But it's spotty. It's only for the most educated women they're getting those perks, and it's not for it's not for the majority. And that's not enough. I mean, that's not going to grow you a whole generation of young kids if a few employers are doing a good job and the rest aren't. It needs to be more of a universal coverage so we can turn this around and get things working in the way that the young woman would like it to go and the way everybody else needs it to go. But you can't force women to have kids, and you can't even pay them to have kids. The only thing you can do is lighten up the time burden that they're facing, because it's such a crunch. If we can focus on that, we would have a chance. I was looking at the trends just the other day since the Great Recession, because I was remembering, okay, we thought there was this uptick happening in fertility around 2012, 2013. The recession was over. We thought, okay, now it's going to turn up again, because there had been a little burst of fertility back in 2006, 2007, right, in the boom before the recession, and then it slumped, and then it started to tick up. I'm looking at it right now. It came up in 2014, and it went 2 years, and then it started diving, especially after 2016, a big dive in the number of babies that are being born. And this is not supposed to happen. We're at the good part of the recovery. We're out of the recession. Incomes are rising, and fertility is diving. And I've been asked this question as to why is that, and people say, well, it's housing costs. People are saddled; they don't know where, they can't find a place, can't find a nest, a suitable nest to have, have babies in there. And it's also discouragement about just the state of the world. There's more uncertainty and doubt, and under those conditions, people don't want to bring a new child into the world. They find that fertility is highest in periods when people are happiest, when there's more optimism in society. And I think this is like a barometer of despair, that young people are just feeling the crunch, and they're feeling put upon, and they don't see any light in the tunnel. And we have to help them feel it.
Well, the pieces of the puzzle that you're talking about, I would imagine that college debt and the overhang of that has something to do with it. What about the reliability or lack thereof of income in the gig economy, where you're basically, having to be very creative to build your own career, and you're not going to be assured of staying with the same company for 4 years, let alone 30 years. And then there are some who say that climate change is on their minds, like in the old days when we used to worry about overpopulation, Paul Ehrlich and so forth, and maybe it's the responsible thing to do for Mother Earth not to have a child. Do you think that those things, you talk to young people all the time at the university, are these things weighing on them?
The student loan debt I used to shrug off as like, that's not so bad. But it's getting to be an enormous burden. It was a temporary, really an emergency action that was taken in the Great Recession. Because the states can't run a deficit, they had to balance the books some way, and so they pushed off their higher education expenses onto the students. They raised tuition, and they encouraged them to take loans. The interest rates on these loans are outrageous, 6 or 7%. I mean, that's highway robbery. So we're asking them to finance their own education, and it's an education that the rest of us need them to get. By the way, you know, one of the advantages of being a college grad is your lifelong earnings are about $1 million higher if you do that. It also means that you're going to be contributing $250,000 more in taxes than someone who only has a high school degree. So we need to raise better students to be better workers, to be better taxpayers. We actually will get the money back down the road. But up front, we ask them to pay the cost, them to bear the burden. And as you said, I mean, the types of jobs that are available are uncertain. In a gig economy, you live hand to mouth. It's not, it doesn't make you comfortable and feel secure enough to make this investment in having a kid.
Do you hear much about climate change in terms of their decisions going forward about having a family or not?
I've never heard that connected directly. I guess I had indirectly. They're all worried about climate change. It's like a religious, spiritual value that they have now that they realize it's happening. They see the evidence of it, and they feel put upon because the older people who are making the decisions aren't going to live with the consequences. And the young people are. They know it's going to fall on them. They also think that their Social Security is going to all be gone. By the time they get there, it's all going to be eaten up by the baby boomers. My own son, we had a blow up at Thanksgiving a couple of years back. Not a violent blow up, but just a gentle eruption. It was him and the aunts over. He was just sort of venting in his frustration. And I'm glad he did, because it's good for us to hear how he's feeling. But yeah, they take it personally, and they take it as being part of their lives. It's not something that can be brushed off. Whereas older people, we're immune. We got our Social Security in hand, and we're going to, live our lives securely, and we just don't feel the pressure of what's happening to young people. And the young people are, again, our topic today, that they are the young people, are the parents, the potential parents of the next generation. So one of the casualties of their angst, of their burden, and their discouragement is this dive in fertility post 2016, it represents that discouragement.
Will the shrinking working age population that we've been talking about, along with the aging population growth, really put major pressure on the social safety net programs, making them truly unsustainable? Because I think we do take comfort, we, the older folks, that, hey, you made this promise. We vote like the Dickens, and you're not going to take anything away. But we do know that even in this budget that was recently put forward by the president, there are some of those cuts around the edges to Medicare, a little bit about Social Security. I mean, can we sustain what it is that we have been promised, as we think?
I'm not a fiscal expert. I think we have to sustain it. Can we? If there's a will, there's a way. I just think that it's a matter of priorities. And again, I believe it's not malice. I just think that the older generation has ideas from the past, and they don't realize how the world has changed. They're just not up to speed. Mm-hmm. And it's not a casual accusation. I've always noticed that everybody is behind the times. It's the most striking thing is even demographers, we joke about it. Because even we are behind the times. We're always surprised when we look at the numbers. We see things that we didn't realize. We sort of run on habit of what we knew. I mean, I have habits. Things I studied, 10 years ago, I think are still true. And then I look at them and, oh, gosh, it really changed. Well, the Great Recession was a major turning point. It changed everything. All the trends are different. And yet the older generation somehow thinks, okay, now we're just continuing along like normal. But young people who came up in that recession, it's not normal for them. They are in a different world.
What about the fact that we're now living with, I think, six generations alive, and that's never happened before? And I was talking to someone else who wrote a book about generational change, and he was saying that there's probably more divide, and I think Shimon Peres, the former prime minister of Israel, said this, among demographic groups going forward than even among nations.
I mean, how is that hyperbole, or does that make some sense to you? And do you think that's going to be evidenced in our politics, the young people saying, hey, you're leaving me way behind here and behind the eight ball while you're at least for the next 20, 30 years enjoying your life? What do you think? Is that going to bring even more tension and friction to an already polarized society?
You know, I'm an optimist. I don't think that way. I mean, I tend to think that a lot of what the divisions are based on rhetoric of how people speak sometimes, and that the real dissension is not nearly as great as the way it sounds, because of how our leaders talk. And yet, underneath it, there are real disparities, and don't mean to make light of those, and we should work on those. There's people who are being left behind in different parts of the country. The Midwest is not faring the same way that California is. They resent California. Just today, I heard somebody, I won't say who, former governor of California, commenting that still 78 cents of, that California gets back 78% of the tax dollars that it sends to the federal government. We're the tax cow for the nation. We are the engine of innovation and job creation, all these things. Also pay high housing prices, but that's all lopsided. It's all happening here, and then the people in the Midwest are left behind, and they feel resentful. They feel like there's some kind of conspiracy of the media, you know, that's based in California or New York, and I can see that too. So that I think that the pace of change is speeding up, and let's put it this way, the pace of change is faster than one generation can grow. And so that creates a greater gap of consciousness.
That's a great point.
There's other ways, though, in which the older generation, like myself and my children, are more similar than I was and my father. My father fought in World War II, and he liked big band music and all that. My sons actually like some of the same kind of music I like, and so there's a cultural affinity. Between generations now that wasn't before, but in other ways there's less helping than there was before. So it's asymmetric, and we need to straighten some things out.
Let me ask you about migration patterns briefly, suburbs, cities, what you're seeing demographically, because a lot of these young people have decided that the future, and they are right in many ways, the economy at least is proving that on the coast, is really in the Bostons, the New Yorks, the Austins, the Los Angeles, San Francisco. So they're gravitating there, and that happens also to be where the housing costs are the highest, where urban lifestyle may not be the most conducive to raising a family. What's going on in that regard as you see it?
You know, there was a belief that millennials were going to stay in the city because that's where they were in 2010, 2012. But at that time, I projected that they would be moving outward because of housing costs. They would move outward into suburbs, and that's happening now. They're still in the city, but they're spreading outward, and the cities are not growing like they were. So there's that myth, and then there's the reality, which is half true. And then moving to the suburbs like their parents, that's half true also. So it's hard to say what it means. And it's different, like in Chicago, than it is in LA. It's the world is becoming, asymmetric. It's just, there was a time when our regions in the country were converging. The South was coming up and other places were coming down. Well, now the South is still going up and other places have now gone below the South. The West is booming, and then the West has the greatest contraction in number of children born. So it's I can't tell you one pattern other than it's lumpy. It's bunched up different places. The people that are left behind, I know, resent it. The town gets older around them. And then all of a sudden a wave of immigrants comes in to occupy the empty storefronts. Thank God they did, because the storefronts would be abandoned, but it's not the same old town they remember, and they're nostalgic for the past. I don't blame them. They don't seem to know what's real. And then other people tell them stories that are you know, fictional or scary. And they're, but they're susceptible because they've been, you know, everything has flown over the top and left them behind. The young people though are having to, you know, we're seeing this now in California. They're having to make hard choices. They like the jobs here. They like the weather here. They like the diversity here. They can't find housing and they're being forced grudgingly to move to Phoenix or, you know, move to Texas, which is a radical leap for someone from California. I live in California. I did live in Austin for 5 years also. So I know where they're going. And the traffic is worse in Austin, I'll tell you that.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because I was reading where California is likely to be losing one congressional seat, Texas picking up three. I know I'm here in the state of Connecticut. We may lose another congressional seat. New England has seen an outpouring of people leaving the places like New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, Connecticut. And, I mean, these are, as you say, very asymmetrical times. With all that said, this is 2020. A census is upon us. And so some of these demographic shifts are really power shifts as well.
We hope it's going to be a good census. I mean, democracy really requires trust. That you trust the scorekeepers, you trust the adjudicators. And if that trust is eroded, democracy will not continue. And the census is sort of a measuring stick. We use it every 10 years. I served on the Census Bureau's advisory board for about a decade before the 2000 census. And so I saw how carefully they try to develop the survey and the procedures so they get as complete a count as possible, something that can be measured from decade to decade to measure real trends and not, you know, measuring mistakes that were made. We're very worried this census might well have gaps in it that makes the Iowa caucus look like it was successful. We're worried about it. It could happen in some states. It's not from ineptitude, it's from malevolent outsiders who could disrupt the whole data collection process. And if you don't collect the data right, then your apportionment is wrong. So it's, you know, democracy rests on having solid numbers that people believe in.
And, well, democracy, we're demography coming together. Dowell Myers, Professor of Urban Planning and Demography at the University of Southern California. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends. Very interesting, and I think you've made people think about these issues perhaps in new ways or for the first time ever, and I'm grateful to you for that. Thank you.
Well, Larry, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.